for 20 of the first 25 years of my ordination, I worked in one function or another on campuses, usually as a professor. And I find it easy coming out of that general Southwest folk culture of Texas to make friends, even on East Coast campuses. And I find it fascinating how easy it is for most people to assume that just because you like a person, that your values are the same. Or that contrary, if your values are different, that you can't like each other. But I'm called to be a missionary on campuses, or was called once to be a missionary in Brazil, or am now called to be a missionary in government service, living in New York City. And I feel myself under orders to like people, to be interested in what they're interested in, to listen to what they want to talk about, to draw them out, to let them find their open road for questing and searching. And yet I find that from most people I'm different, that I hear a different voice, that I have different hopes and goals, that only rarely when I gather with friends, new and old, in a place like this, do I really sense a feeling of shared values and commitment. So I'm in the world. I made the conscious choice many years ago to live in the world and not to stay inside the confines of the beloved community, as Dr. King called it, of hope and trust and faith. That's the church. And to be in the world is to love the world, but to suffer because you're different. So we're called upon to love the world, the secular world, and to interact with the world and not to judge it. And perhaps the most difficult thing that we have to learn is it is not our task to judge. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. And we come now and then, I suppose, with a special mandate to bring the word of judgment, though that's hardly ever given to me. But always we're called upon to bring the word of love and reconciliation. Three times I've chosen difficult fields, or what seemed to me to be difficult fields, to be a missionary. First time I chose to go to Brazil. I wanted a job that was important, that was significant, that was difficult, that no one else wanted, because I had become perplexed with the competitiveness of my brothers and sisters in the clergy. And I thought that it was detrimental to the spirit of community that ought to characterize the Christian clergy, that I should have to compete with my brothers and sisters for a bigger church, or in the old days, for a parsonage with running water. In Brazil, there was no competition. I had a job that nobody wanted. It was a difficult job. I was an outsider. I was an American. I was a Protestant in a society that was largely Catholic. And my job was to win the people's confidence, to understand them in order that they could trust me. The second time I was called to be a professor on a secular campus. Now, that's one of the most difficult intellectual climates in which to live, because American academic culture has an underlay of a basic assumption of superiority, of what I might call genteel snobbishness, that assumes that anyone that has a BA is better than anyone that doesn't, and assumes that one of the purposes of a college education, one of the unsaid purposes, is to make the person who's receiving the degree feels at least slightly superior from those who didn't go to college. Indeed, I would argue that probably the most serious social chasm we have in our society today is the distrust between those who went to university and those who didn't. And fascinatingly enough, it's a chasm that's not recognized by most who did go to college. But I assure you it's there. But I was living with the elite, with a faculty of tenured professors in Washington, D.C. And I am a confessing Christian. I get confused in my past tense now because I'm on leave, not as a Christian, but as a tenured professor. And they found this passing strange. I passed all the tests, wrote articles, gave papers, lectured, could carry on a witty conversation that didn't have any real purpose, you know, all those tests of being a tenured professor. And yet I was an Orthodox believing Christian. And how to maintain the tension is the problem. Loving the world, being in the world, yet maintaining one's own identity. And the third one is the most recent one. Now, 9 years ago, as a professor in Washington, teaching international relations about American diplomacy, U.S. foreign policy, I became so upset after many years with U.S. foreign policy that I made a promise to myself that I would never, never go in the building of the Department of State. And I didn't for 8 years. True enough, they very seldom invited me in because, you know, they knew what I thought, and I knew what they thought. But I finally went in last year, January of last year, late January, walking side by side with Andrew Young. Well, not an easy thing. Because for those of us who had been in the anti-war movement, for those of us who had been in the freedom movement, the civil rights movement, the poor people's movement, for those of us who lived in Latin America and watched the U.S. government betray democracy, impose dictatorships upon suffering peoples and enhance their suffering, the Department of State had become a symbol of oppression and indifference. So here I am, who I am, a populist that believes more in the common sense of the common folks than I do in the wisdom of the elite. A liberationist who believes that all people want to be free, that freedom's not something that was invented by Anglo-Saxons and that can only be practiced effectively in industrialized Western countries. Here I am, living in the midst of a careerist and professionalist culture, characterized, in my opinion, by a good deal of national chauvinism and a good deal of elitism. And I'm called to love that world and to make a witness to it. Well, I don't want to draw any conclusions from my experience. I'm too busy living my experience to reflect on it. I'm too busy trying to think about what it means to be an official of the U.S. government and also a Christian, concerned about human rights and democracy in the world, to reflect much about what it means for anybody else. But I suppose that's healthy too. I don't want to reflect for you on your life. I find that the moments of inspiration and support that I find from my fellow believers comes not when they reflect on my life for me, but when they reflect on their lives to me. And in a sense, that's what I'm trying to do for you today. I'm not recommending my attitudes or my politics. Well, I guess I might if I had time. But I'm not right now recommending my politics. I'm just trying to say that the Lord has led me in this way, and that I think of myself as a missionary and as a pilgrim, and that I have been able to do what I have been able to do, as little as it may have been, because I have been able to keep in contact with the support groups. And I found two groups especially to be terribly meaningful to me, and I want to recommend them to you. The first is the local congregation. I spent a good deal of my life the past 20 years, as I think Alan probably has, trying to encourage many of my dear Catholic friends to stay in the church. They get more disillusioned, I guess, than I do. I guess I never expected too much of Methodism. Therefore, I never got too disillusioned with it. I feel at home. I think. I feel. I'm a Methodist to my toe tips. But Methodism, with all of its other problems, never has pretended to be perfect. And I guess that Catholicism has made that mistake sometime. And both Dr. Neely and I have seen many Catholics in Latin America who suddenly discovered what was obvious many years ago in the Reformation, that the church was pretentious, the church was arrogant, the church was insensitive to poor people, the church was insensitive to suffering, the church was insensitive to oppression, and indeed often an agent of oppression. They become disillusioned and want to leave. So I've tried to persuade them to stay in. I've tried to persuade them that there were great, beautiful things there, that the Holy Spirit was working inside the Catholic Church in Latin America. We've all seen it. It's power, beauty. It gives people courage to suffer, to sacrifice with a glory in their hearts. And I've never been tempted to leave the local congregation. I like it. Maybe I like it too much. And I've always found a strange thing. I've gotten in trouble a few times in my life. I won't enumerate them now. They were always for saying the right thing at the wrong time, or what other people thought was the wrong time. That's why I got thrown out of Brazil. And I've discovered a strange thing, that the church never understood what I was doing and never understood why I said what I said. Those little churches in Arkansas and Texas that supported us as missionaries didn't understand why I did what I did. But even though they didn't understand, they stood behind me all the way. They backed us. They continued to love us and to receive us. They didn't ask us to justify what would happen. They knew that we were an apparent disgrace. You know, to get thrown out of a country by the military is apparently a disgrace, I guess, to some people. But they always have stood behind me. And several times else that I've had similar experiences, the people that I've known in congregations, in other walks of life, most of them in humble walks, who didn't pretend to be interested or to understand what I was doing, always stood by me. The congregation, the worshiping congregation, is a source of beauty, a source of community, and a source of support. And I've never found a congregation that wouldn't take you in if you went in humbly and wanting to learn from them, and with the expectation that God was there before you were, that you weren't coming to bring the truth, you were coming to find it. And the second support mechanism that's been terribly important to me has been something that we call the freedom movement. Now, you know, the freedom movement was what Dr. King called his movement. It was a movement that believed in the common people. It was a movement that believed that peace is the way, that nonviolence is powerful, that radical social change is necessary, but that it can be achieved through reconciliation. In fact, that democracy and more democracy can only be achieved through nonviolent reconciliation of all peoples to one another. That to do this, sometimes you have to bring problems out into the open and people have to discuss them, and that upsets people because the people who are at ease don't want to talk about the problems that keep other people in misery. But the movement is a group of people who are banded together, who are brought together as surely as much by the Spirit of God as is the church. The movement has no frontiers, just like the church has no frontiers. The movement has no one dogma or one focus, just like the church has no one dogma or focus. The freedom movement is made up of people who love freedom and who love justice, and who are seeking to liberate people all over the world. I guess I'd think that, historically speaking, maybe Moses was the first liberation leader when he took his people out of Egypt. And ever since then, there have been movements. I want to confess that it's a beautiful thing that's happening in my church. And I don't mean to comment, I don't know what's going on in the Southern Baptist Convention. I have a hard enough time keeping up what's going on in the United Methodist Church. But it's a beautiful thing happening in my church now. When I was at my seminary a year or so ago, spoke in the chapel, over a third of the student body is now female. First thing I noticed was the difference it made in the singing. You know, it used to be we had 600 men singing in the chapel. Now, a third of the voices are female. It does really radically change the. I guess that's the part I don't like very much. I really like that 600 male voices. But what it's doing to the ministry of my church is a beautiful thing to behold. That we're now changing our concept imperceptibly, without plan, without even a study commission. Can you imagine Methodism doing anything without a study commission? It's happening. And we are developing a broader, deeper understanding of what it means to be ordained, what it means to be clergy. Why? Because now we have over 400 women ordained. And because they're past the stage, most of them are of being angry. They just want to get on with the job. They're searching with all us old-timers, and all the new ones too, about what it means to be a minister of the church in 1978. This is part of the freedom movement. We are discovering constantly new perspectives, new vistas. We never know where God is going to open a door. We never know what window is going to be suddenly opened and what new air is going to come in. God leads. And the beautiful thing about the church and about the freedom movement is you can make friends instantly. You can discover instant, profound relationships when you discover a fellow militant, a person who's been in the movement, the freedom movement, who's paid the dues, made the sacrifices, run the risk. And you never knew the person before, maybe you never heard of the person before. But when you discover a person like that, it's like an oasis in the middle of a desert. So to be a missionary is not without compensation. To be a missionary is to be lonely sometimes, to be misunderstood often, to live in the world and to love the world, and yet the world does not understand. But it's not without compensation. Well, I'm called to be a missionary. I didn't choose it. Sometimes I'm not happy with it. Sometimes it's a burden. But most of the time, it's a pleasure and a joy. I miss being all the time with church folks. I miss being part 7 days a week of a Christian fellowship. I miss the joys of living in a seminary. One of my great temptations is to try to go teach in a seminary. As Alan was saying this morning, one of the problems with seminaries is they tend to become monasteries, and I guess I'm sort of tempted that direction. I get tired sometimes of living outside. But I'm not the only one. There are not just a few of you called to be missionaries and to be pilgrims and to be strangers. I dare to say that all of you are called to be pilgrims and strangers, to cross cultural boundaries, to cross class boundaries, to cross religious boundaries, to make friends with the stranger and the outcast on mutually satisfactory terms and not on your terms alone, to accept the new as possibly the leading of the Spirit, to be the one who's always searching for new truth rather than the one who's husbanding old truth of the last generation. Be a pilgrim, to wander in new ways, unsure of the exact next step, but always certain of the leading of the Spirit of God. Well, to be a missionary in our time, in our place, means to be sensitive to the struggles and aspirations of other peoples. The greatest sermons that have been preached in this year in this country probably have been preached by Jimmy Carter. When he talked in his inaugural address about the aspirations of the people of the world, how strange it should be that the president should dare to say these things when so many of us who speak in pulpits are too timid. We must dare to say that the majority of the people of the world are struggling for dignity and freedom, that we live at the beginning of what can be a new age of freedom for the whole world, that we live at the beginning of an age that can forget the skepticism and cynicism of the past decades, that can learn a better way than making war, that we live at the beginning of an age in which those old dreams can become real once again, that all people can be free, that no child needs to die from hunger, that every person can have decent medical care, that no person needs to be put in jail and tortured because of their political beliefs, that we live at a time in which all that can be true. There are many agendas, there are many calls. But history gives us all some part of our own agenda. And you may be called to do pastoral work or to be an evangelist. And even as I, in my involvement and absorption in the human rights foreign policy of Jimmy Carter, can never forget that I am also called to be an evangelist and to be a pastor. So you, called to be an evangelist and be a pastor, cannot forget that the God of fathers has called you to be an instrument of his justice and his prophecy in our time. And God is raising up all over the world a mighty witness to the desire and hunger of peoples for freedom and for justice. And he calls upon you to share that. He calls upon you to cross that racial barrier in the South and to discover the richness that we have in our own people that can be set free when we break down that barrier and become one people who learn to love one another and trust one another. And you know as well as I know how deep those barriers still are and how timid most of us are for fear of hearing the voice of the Lord. I salute this house. It's a privilege to be here. The beauty and the truth and the love that you bring out of this house to the fields in which you labor and which you will labor is known far and wide. And the joys and strength of the Southern Baptist Convention are a source of gratitude and thanksgiving to many of us. I thank you for the privilege of being here. Thank you.
O Lord, you have warned us that you will require much more of us to whom much is given. You have created us all in your own image. Now grant us courage to contend fearlessly against evil, to make no peace, to strike no bargain with oppression. Help us to use our freedom to establish beachheads of justice and righteousness in all the world through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.